else to a process of producing electricity by nuclear fuel. And in the meantime, up until about the 1990s, that's when they're expecting to have these systems on the go, they're saying we'll exploit coal as much as we can to tide us over until we've got enough nuclear reactors in order to supply this kind of fuel. But of course, they've chosen it because nuclear-powered electricity is easy to transport and takes the pressure off liquid fuels, which are needed for cars and lorries and sort of things like that. But of course, there are enormous social dangers. You're concentrating all your eggs in one basket. What happens if you have something really go wrong with one of these nuclear reactors? You've got no reserves to fall back on. So increasingly, there is a lobby for alternative energy sources. Let's use wind, let's use water as well, perhaps, or maybe not at all, use nuclear power. There's a real debate going on, which really cuts to the heart of democracy. And then finally, and really flying on from that, is the whole ecological crisis. That's another flashpoint. The whole kind of infrastructure that we've created in the world today is crumbling under its own weight because we're extracting natural resources to live in the technological way in which we do, and yet there's a limit to them. We're almost pulling down the house around our ears. Someone has said technology isn't a magician. Everything we consume comes from the earth. Therefore, we're sort of destroying this beautiful, balanced sort of system that God has created in the world, where things destroy and die and are reborn, and this sort of natural balance of ecology, to things which at the end we have simply piles and piles of waste. We're creating a simple system out of what was a complex system and a beautifully balanced system. And really, in the end, we're just going to be, choking on our own sick because of all the waste, that we're creating. And, it's a serious question, really, for us as the people of God, to be a prophetic voice into this sort of situation. Agriculture has become very much agribusiness. Pesticides are sprayed to kill weeds. But this makes the new plants that we've got, the new crops that we've got, more vulnerable to disease. The fertilizers we have are inorganic, and so they silt up our rivers and our lakes. The fish die. So altogether, all sorts of problems being created by the new technology, this new dream Coca-Cola culture that we're all living in. Forests are being cleared at an enormous rate in order to exploit natural resources. Dust bowls are being made everywhere. Brazil has seen 25% of the Amazon rainforest destroyed in 25 years. And already it's affected the climate. Southeast Asia, 80% of its forests have been leased to timber companies. 40% of the world's farmers live in valleys that depend on the sponge effect of trees. As a result, there'll either be erosion or they'll be flooded out, if the water table or the climate changes dramatically. And of course, all sorts of animals and things like this are being destroyed as a result. And then finally, sort of in terms of ecology, there's the whole crisis over nuclear power, nuclear waste. It's estimated that by the year 2000 AD, USA will handle 100,000 nuclear shipments from one place to another. And these could, of course, be attacked by terrorists. There could be all sorts of accidents. And we're living very much on a trigger sort of base of problems that could take place. That's the world we live in terms of its structure. Now, let's try and quickly get to the spirit of the age, of 20th century man. The spirit of an age springs from the heart of its children. The forces, the attitudes, the aspirations, the assumptions of 20th century man. What are they? What does 20th century man sort of think and feel? Now, obviously, you look and you see, and we're making generalizations here, but I think we can tie them up in a number of headings and sort of focus in on what the kind of creature who's living in this age really is. What are the hopes and aspirations of people today? First of all, he's affluent. There's an assumption and an expectation of abundance. Consumer goods are available on a lavish scale. There's an expectation of more and more for less and less effort. There really is a belief that we can move towards utopia if we've got enough money and enough expertise. There really is an arrogant affluence in 20th century man. Naturally flowing from that, there's this optimism. That all problems can be solved given time, given the expertise. Even war can be brought to an end. And it's strange that although we've seen the most terrible disasters in war this century, optimism always springs up. After the Great War, they wanted to get back to the good old days of the 1940s. So you had the flapper of the 20s in the bottle clubs, and it was the great day of living it up in the 20s. And of course, that fell short in the Depression. But then again, since 1945, there's been hope for the American dream, the pursuit of pleasure. And even though we've got enormous economic problems today, people believe, yeah, we can get them through. The depression is tailing off. There's going to be an upturn soon. Hope springs eternal. And yet, as people have said, hope unfulfilled makes the heart sick, as we shall see. Secular man is humanist. His faith and hope lies in science. The growth of science in a scale and a complexity which generates an awe. The scientist is now held with the reverence of a priest. And science is held with the respect of sort of theology and God. That's where man's hopes lie. And we've got a sort of authority lies in the hands of these people. There's a new elite which can manipulate society. And they really believe that technology and science will bring us to utopia. Individualism. No previous century has emphasized individualism in the way in which ours has. Human rights, individual freedoms are demanded by everybody. Everybody must be free to fulfill their own hypothesis. Whatever turns you on, man, do your own thing. You know, we demand that our private life not be intruded. And we live in a world with our own television, our own car, our own telephone. We monitor what we allow to come into us. And therefore, modern man is very, very hard to reach because he's cocooned himself in his little private world with this wall of technology around him. And he believes it's his right to live like that. It's permissive. It's an age of a demise of fixed standards. Relativity has become the watchword. Truths and principles and institutions once thought beyond question have now been torn down. Religious disputes, scientific discoveries have seemingly eroded people's idea there are any accepted standards. All values are relative. Now, we see this most clearly in art. It's incredible, the change in the way that 20th century man's spirit is reflected in his art. The scope of change is unprecedented. Traditional forms of art have been rejected and recast. The very idea of what art is has been challenged. There's been a movement away from representing the form to getting behind and expressing the human values and feelings of things. Expressionism sought realities that the eye cannot see. It looked for universals. Abstract art looked beyond the skin of nature into the deeper structure of reality. Cubism tried to break down the image to show all its sides of reality, all its feelings, its moods, its dimensions. They reached back to try and get in harmony with primitive art, which tried to tie itself into the sort of the spirit in nature. All this came to a head, as amazingly, in 1907, when Picasso painted this picture, Les Demoiselles d'Avignon, which really crystallized all the thinking that had gone on just in these few early years in art. And it's composed of three main elements. First of all, geometry. We see really sort of white numbers on a blackboard. The women, obviously prostitutes, are not people. They're just mere objects. So this human form, which has been revered so long, is now just, as I said, scratchings on a blackboard. There's masks, and you see the primitive masks there. Primitive man hides behind a mask to try and become one with the spirit of the world, and that was the idea that Picasso had here. And also, can you see the force, the angles that have obviously come out of cubism in this picture? There's violence in this picture, a feeling of expression. And this is the artist expressing his own frustration, his own feeling, his own desire to find whatever universal meaning there is in the world in a painting. And it all comes through in this, what is really a milestone in modern art. Really, modern art was born sort of out of this painting. When Picasso's friend saw it, he described it as a philosophical brothel, which is probably the most brilliant description of it, because that's exactly what it was, all the ideas that it contained, and yet what the picture also represented. Picasso didn't find what he was looking for, but what he did is he released the spirits of anarchy, of nihilism, and absurdity. In 1913, Marcel Duchamp took a logical step on from Picasso and painted this painting. It's called Nude Descending a Staircase. Now, the human form is gone completely. Someone has described it as a nun moving swiftly in the ceremonial dress of a samurai, which I think is brilliant. But you see, it's nihilism. The thing about Duchamp, if you can say anything in his favour, obviously, he wasn't afraid to take ideas to their logical conclusion. He's saying, man is dead, there is nothing. And this is where modern art has gone. And someone has said that if you had an exhibition of modern art, the key paintings of modern art, from the turn of the century to 1920, you would find all the main themes of modern art there. That really everything from then has really been sort of developing them in some way, but all the key chords have been struck by that time. And this is really, you know, one of the end pieces of that thing happening. We have, you know, all sorts of things in would be in such an exhibition. New methods of depicting reality, collage, the use of colour, the search for the absolute, absurdity, negation of all values, and pan-eroticism. And this takes us on then to another hallmark of 20th century man, introspection. Friedrich Nietzsche, who actually died in 1900, proclaimed that God is dead. Man is alone in the world. He's the sole arbiter of his own destiny. And this led to arrogance in some, but to great introspection and even despair in the hearts of others. Sigmund Freud went on to sort of look into man and develop the whole idea of psychology. He probed the mind for repression, for guilt, for neurosis. He sought to free man, but he freed man, you know, only into an abyss. You know, he left him with nothing. But there was this real introspective spirit flying through so many of Nietzsche's and Freud's and those who took that ideas. Martin Heidegger, very important philosopher, said, man stands anxious within the world. His only hope is within himself as a being. Jean-Paul Sartre said, the only way in which man can have any meaning in the world is by acting by his will. It makes no matter if you're driving along in a car, an old lady is at the side of the road, you stop and lead her across the road, or you run her over. It doesn't make it. Morally, there's no difference. You simply decide on doing something and you do it, and in that way you authenticate yourself. That is the sort of the end to which sort of the nihilistic thinking had gone. And man sort of searched for meaning within a world that he now had opened the lid of, had become a Pandora's box, and even hope seemed to have escaped. And introspection led on to pessimism. The vanishing point, there was nothing. This painting, called The Cry or The Scream, was actually painted in 1893 by Edvard Munch, but it illustrates. He said, I feel a screaming throughout nature, a despair, and he was trying to communicate this. And it's becoming louder and louder, really, as the century progressed. All the taboos were broken, but man was left simply not with joy and freedom, but with ugliness and brutality. Alienation produced sadism, evil, hell, and a horrific black humour. You know, man sort of feels himself imprisoned in an absurd world, which has no meaning at all. Probably the British artist Francis Bacon, you know, is an end piece as far as this is concerned. He said himself, man now realizes he's an accident, a completely futile being, having to play out a game without reason. Man can now only beguile himself for a time. Someone has described Bacon's art as being full of misery, despair, alienation, and decay. He's a man who painted paralytic, neurotic, leprous schizoids that move about in cages. You know, that is where 20th century man has come to. It's a cul-de-sac. And of course, because of that, you can see why so many people in our age are turning to the occult and to things like that. Because man is without hope, so he looks for hope in darkness rather than in light. But of course, very few people can live with the courage of men like Marcel Duchamp and others like that, and Bacon. Most people would go insane, and many people are in our mental hospitals because of that. And so most 20th century men and women are escapists at the bottom line. Okay, they can't live with the nihilism, and so they create this little world around them. They fuel it with their own pleasures, their own ideas. They're too afraid even to ask the questions, because they know there aren't any answers. So they try and blot out the questions with loud music and bright lights and things like that. The Brave New World, the members of the Brave New World, seek refuge in an illusion. Sometimes it's been drugs, sometimes drink. Seeking to blot out the painful reality. Timothy Leary, who was the promoter of the drugs cult of the 1960s, said, death to the mind, nothing else will do. Now, They've often sought it in illusion in the either the small screen of the television or the wide screen of the cinema, the illusion of beauty, the illusion of love, and the illusion of a pseudo-hero with a false or an empty morality. You know, that's where he looks, you know, he's escaping into something which is not real, because the door he has opened into reality, because he's turned his back on God, is something that he can't cope with. Now, not everybody has been prepared, I like my friend here, has been prepared to accept this situation. Line. He's not been prepared just to sit down and take it as it comes. And throughout, you know, the spirit of our age, there is a cry of protest, of this angry person who wants things to be different. Sometimes it's been a cry like that. Sometimes the protest has been the self-immolation of a Buddhist monk here protesting against the atrocities in Vietnam, pours petrol over himself and burns himself alive, hoping that somebody will hear what he's trying to say with the ultimate sacrifice of himself. Now, obviously, a key strand that runs through this protest has been what has been glibly called the youth quake. Rebellious youth are present in every age in history. But, you know, rebellious youth has erupted up into a sort of a volcano in our age, creating a new consciousness. And, of course, music has very much been the media by which the youth quake has expressed itself. The 1920s and 30s saw the rising popularity of the blues that was born out of, you know, the conditions in which the blacks found themselves in America. But, of course, it soon became popularized, and people took up the rhythms that the blues had given them. The melodies, new melodies, were put. And in the 1940s and 50s, rock and roll comes on the line. 53 saw Bill Haley and, of course, the great king of rock and roll, Elvis Presley. And this gave rise to the Teddy Boys and the Mods and the Rockers, the Skinheads, and, of course, we have the punk rockers of the 1970s. A rhythm, beat and love, of course, were the stuff of the music of youth. But very soon, the youth quake began to take on board the issues of the day. And so people like Paul Simon, the Rolling Stones, the Beatles, and the great prophet, really, of the youth protest movement, Bob Dylan, began to sing out the times they are a-changing. They began to protest against the injustice, particular things. They said, we want something different. We want a new world. It may have been the issue of the nuclear the possible nuclear holocaust. It may have been conditions of people in the third world. Whatever it was, they felt they wanted to see justice and right, and they sang out and shouted out about it. Now, in 1962, in Haight Ashbury district of San Francisco, it was once a decaying, overcrowded suburb, saw a new phase of boutiques and fine art studios established by a new bohemian set. They'd moved out from the old beatnik areas. And although they were out of the public eye in 62, the pot, very literally, was boiling. And in 64, the spotlight was focusing on them. Timothy Leary's psychedelic cult was gaining ground. Ken Casey and the Merry Pranksters were urging people to take the acid test, which is, of course, taking LSD. There was a flood of Eastern mysticism in the form of Zen, TM, and the Maharishi, yoga, Sufism, the Hare Krishna movement. And all this began to show this desire for something, some spiritual experience, away from the materialism. But it was very much experienced. Then in the summer of 1967, Scott McKenzie recorded his famous record, San Francisco, which heralded a new generation with a new explanation. And the hippie era was born. Music between 1965 and 1968 carried the drug and escapist culture right across the world in a way, but through its music in a way that probably few other ideas were communicated so fast. And without technology, it couldn't have happened. And a whole new way of thinking. People look back on the 60s being the great day. And yet, of course, it was a time of tremendous tragedy as well. 1969, the whole hippie movement came to a climax with the huge music festival of Woodstock. Now, not far away from the sort of where hippie things were happening, in 1964 in the University of Berkeley, another more intellectual protest was taking place and developing. They were pioneering here the ideas of an alternative society. There was the free speech movement on the university campus, with a strong political emphasis. Following that was the dirty speech movement, where people got to the microphone and just shouted obscenities out. Sort of, I suppose they felt they were cleansing themselves, or maybe they're making some comment on society of the time. And all sorts of eruptions in proclaiming what people wanted, what was right, what was reality, took place. This led to student unrest and the birth of what was called the New Left. It opposed USA involvement in Vietnam, the threat of nuclear war, bureaucratic control in universities. Issues of relationships with people were brought out into the open, and there was a desire for a whole new way of living, new political patterns. 1968, all this came to a high point with the student revolts and demonstrations in Paris, in London, in Tokyo, and in Mexico. So the days of Daniel Cole Bendit, or Danny the Red as he was called, the Sorbonne, Grosvenor Square, Tariq Ali, the LSE, probably many of you remember them, and this cry out for something different. Now these weren't people who were sort of uneducated, just out for a laugh. These were serious young people, educated young people who really wanted to see something new. The New Left was born, as I've said. The women's movement was born out of it. The Black Consciousness movement was born out of it. But in the 1970s, the whole youth protest movement really had begun to become washed out. In August 1970, the Rolling Stones had a concert in America, which was policed by the Hells Angels, as a result of which a man was murdered. And in their next issue of their magazine, Rolling Stone, they said this: "Our age of innocency has gone." And there you see someone sitting with all the trash, really, in a sense of the 60s, the hopes of the 60s, like rubbish on the floor. Many people simply embraced materialism. They became, you know, the alcoholism of their parents became their own drug addiction. The adultery of their parents became their new sexual permissiveness. But, the tide had gone out. Others, who really still hoped, but took on violence and joined many of the new revolutionary groups which were found around the world and which are behind many of the political and terrorist movements of today. Now, time has gone. I am not finished. How many people would like me to try and just very quickly sort of summarise the rest of what I've got to say? Okay? I'll try and get down as quick as I can. If you feel you need to go, please, would you like to go now? Ken, would you just like to kill the tape? And I'll just quickly pick through the rest of what I've got to say. Okay. Of course, out of the spirit of protest, there was also a real spirit of uprising. Particularly seen in communist countries, so that in 56 we have Hungary, in 68 we have Czechoslovakia, and in 1980 and still into the present time we've got the situation in Poland. And it's interesting to reflect, the desire there was for communism with a human face. That was the cry in Czechoslovakia. And it's interesting to reflect on Andrei Malrach, who was asked this question, can there really be communism with a human face? And he replied, "Historical experience suggests that there can't be." And so within the communist bloc, there's a desire for change, that the hopes of the utopia that communism said they would produce, has run into the sand. But of course, they're locked into a situation now that they find impossible to throw off. And so this leads us, really, this whole 20th century man, the world is created for himself, into a real social crisis, which is all around. There's a crisis of escapism, alcoholism. There's over 100 million alcoholics in the United States. Hidden alcoholism. The majority of alcoholics are middle-aged women who are locked into their homes or feel themselves locked into their homes. And so they drink when their husband's out to work and the children are at school, and they can be unconscious for days on end. Drugs, stimulants like smoking and pot, LSD, people who are dependent on medication. It's another whole need. TV and video. It's estimated that youngsters between 5 and 14 years old in the Western world watch an average of 25 hours television a week. And that in itself is a drug, and it's escapism. And the whole video thing, the problem now of seeing horror films in your own home, uncensored, is a real problem. Relationships, sexual permissiveness, new attitudes. 1973, there were 58,000 unmarried mothers in Britain. Divorces, 1 in 2 in the United States, 1 in 3 in Britain. Homosexuality, with this, you've probably seen the programs about the new AIDS disease they discovered, which breaks down total resistance in the body and is transmitted largely, if not exclusively, through homosexual relationship. Venereal disease. Abortions in Britain, 2 million since 1967. Between the war and 1976, there were in excess of 50 million legal abortions in Japan alone, which is incredible. Violence, battered babies, battered wives, and yet one of the arguments for abortion is that it will save child abuse, but it doesn't. Violence, crime has increased. In 1981, just to give you a focus on this, it was estimated there was one murder every 24 minutes in America, one rape every 7 minutes, and one break-in every 10 seconds. And, you know, we're not far behind that over in Europe at times. In Britain, there were 41,000 prisoners in Borstals in Britain, showing the way crime has affected youth. And, of course, this leads on to despair. There's isolation. The new patterns of the nuclear family leave old people separated from their families, scattered around, to be taken care of by old people's homes or just neglected altogether. One quarter of all the world's illnesses is mental. And yet only 1% of all the world's medical resources are devoted to mental illness. And yet we, of course, know that even that won't help, that it's only God that's going to bring an answer in there. And so let's look at, just very quickly, a couple of the cries for justice. Women and liberation. It's been interesting that the most high subscribed seminar this morning in Festival has been the one about women, which didn't surprise me at all. And it shows that the whole women's consciousness that has been present in this century, you know, really has affected the church and raised questions which we have got to come to terms with as much as the world has. Early in the 19th century, the idea that women should have equal rights with men was completely unheard of. It was nonsense. You know, how dare you think God could have even thought such a thing? You know, was the idea women just told to sit down and shut up and be quiet. But slowly the aspirations for women's rights, which was called the cause, arose. And women decided early on that if they could get the vote, then other things could be won. But they had to win the vote first, and so the suffrage movement started. In 1903, Emmeline Pankhurst founded the Women's Political and Social Union, nicknamed the Suffragettes. And they campaigned vigorously, as you know, and eventually became militant. They chained themselves to railings. They threw themselves under horses. They were prepared. They used hunger strikes. They suffered terribly themselves. But actually, it was the First World War that really helped them, because when the men were fighting in the trenches, the women were running the factories at home. And women were seen to be able to do what men could do. And that began to release the shackles that they felt themselves in. And after the war, sort of in 1918, women were given the vote at 30. That was thought safe. You see, there was a majority of women in Britain. They thought if they had the vote under 30, you know, well, heaven knows what will happen. But in 1928, they got the vote at the age of 21. And, of course, women and men have matched, you know, as it went down to 18. Girls have matched that. But once the vote was won, then they began to move towards other social and economic issues that concerned women. And really, the whole women's movement has never died, although the 1960s saw a sort of a revitalizing, really, of women's liberation. It was born out of very much the new left, the new consciousness movement that was around in the 60s, the work amongst the civil rights, the whole new left movement looking for more honest relationships. Women got in groups. They began talking about, you know, they saw themselves as being politically oppressed. Got themselves in all sorts of cul-de-sacs of thinking, you know, whether shaving their legs was a political act. And you have women who are now are political lesbians, you know, who will not have relationships with men because they want to sort of put men in a corner so they will have to hear what they've got to say. But tragically, of course, you know, the whole thing is ending off in other areas of perversion. And yet there's a lot of good has come out of the women's movement. A lot of women today really do have a sense of freedom, of self-worth, of purpose. I believe even within it's made us as Christians ask questions, free ourselves, you know, from any of the restraints that we have imbibed through our history, of women really, you know, finding their place and their right and their freedoms. And it really has brought a whole new wave of sort of thinking in the world today. Very interesting quote that someone summed up, said, "There are now a significant number of women who walk uneasily in the ways of their fathers, but only partially touch the world of their mothers." just quite a succinct comment on some of the changes that have been brought about as a result of the women's movement. It's a big study, I have a lot more on it there, but we'll leave it. But another cry for justice, of course, is in the whole area of race and prejudice. The blacks in America, they were given emancipation in 1865. But in the southern states, of course, they were still treated as second-class citizens. At the end of the First World War, in which blacks in the United States fought for the Americans, they went back to the southern states in their uniform, and immediately in one town, 19 of them were hung. As if to say, don't think that because you fought in the war and you come back wearing an American soldier's uniform, that gives you any more rights in our eyes. And of course, the Ku Klux Klan reinforced that sort of attitude. The blacks in the north, although there wasn't quite the same oppression sort of ingrained, they really had the poorer jobs, they lived in ghettos, and so all sorts of problems they faced there in those days. The first real step forward came with the bus boycott in Alabama in 1955, led by the then unknown minister called Martin Luther King. He began to lead civil rights demonstrations, totally non-violently, very influenced by Gandhi. Sit-ins, freedom rides, pickets, marches, demonstrations. It's actually fabulous to read the stories of what these people do, the suffering that they went through. Ranchers would come in with the things, big electric prodders that they used to use to move cattle, and they would go up and they would give powerful electric shocks to these people. But, you know, time and time again, they would just sit there and non-violently resist, just saying, we want civil rights. But, of course, there was the whole idea that they could bring about a change non-violently came to a head when Martin Luther King was assassinated. And by that time, the black Muslim movement in America had begun, and they were feeling more and more towards using violence. And with the death of Martin Luther King, violence erupted, and we had the birth of the Black Power and then the Black Panther movement, which, although by the 1970s, again, had really run its course. Many blacks had found a place in society. There was also a very strong white backlash. But the conditions amongst the blacks in America, you know, and the rights and the freedoms they really feel, you know, there's still much, much more that needs to be done. This is a whole ingrained sort of feeling, you know, that people still have, and the changes have not taken place. Britain, of course, can't point our finger at other countries and say that we're exempt to this. Remember the Chinese say when you point your finger at somebody else, you've got three pointing at yourself, and it's very much the case over racism in Britain. We brought in the 50s, to aid our sort of ravaged, war-torn economy, many people from India and from the Caribbean. They took on the most menial jobs, and they lived in the most run-down cities. And it has served to cause, you know, a real sort of problem in many of our inner-city areas in this country. People have said that in Britain, we now are in the situation that America was in the 1920s. Some of the heat has been taken out of the situation by having community groups and government-aided projects. But time and again, you hear youths interviewed on television, and you know the thing is not going to go away, that the problems have not been solved, and that we really have got to look the issue in the face, and, you know, the people of God have got to be a voice into this situation. And perhaps the classic example of racism this century is apartheid in South Africa, where it's written in to the government code, where people are separated, and yet the whites actually, you know, could not have the kind of lifestyle without the work of the blacks in their factories, in their mines, in their homes. And yet every attempt at resistance, whether it's Sharpeville in 1960 or Soweto in 76, has always been put down very, very forcibly. And if you see the film on Gandhi, you'll see a very good example of that there as well. And so the whole race issue is something that's very, very much to the fore in the world in which we live in. But then, of course, there are minorities. There are the refugees. It is estimated that since 1945 there have been over 40 million refugees from over 80 countries in the world. That at this moment there are 12 million refugees worldwide. Of course, some of the most recent examples have been the boat people from the Far East. But in the Horn of Africa today there are 12 million refugees in the conflict there. So it's a huge problem amongst the minorities. There are prisoners of conscience. People who have been put in prison because they disagree with the government. And that is another, you know, group of minorities who are suffering in our times. And of course, many people, many minorities wanting to speak in words that will be understood have resorted to terrorism. And so you get the IRA, you get the PLO and these other groups who've taken to the gun who've taken to hijacking, skyjacking, bank holdups. They look for some great event when the world's eyes will be there, and they move in and they try and hold the world to ransom so they will hear what is being said. And on one hand, you can understand why they do it, because they feel unjust. On the other hand, obviously, we're appalled by the way they do it. But these are, you know, some of the challenges that minorities present us today. And then finally, and very quickly, to move in to look at the church. It's been an incredible century of growth and of conflict for the church. Russia, which was the centre of the Orthodox Church, is now communist. Italy, which is the centre of the Roman Catholic Church, cradled fascism. Britain, which was once the missionary centre of the world, has lost that role. The third world nations of the world is where church is really growing apace. That's the exciting thing. And of course, it's a tremendous challenge to us, you know, for us to key in on what God is doing, but to rejoice in what he is doing in third world countries. Although the church has probably suffered more than at any other age before, it is also growing today faster than at any previous age. There's been attempts to move to unity. There's been the ecumenical movement, but of course we know how that, you know, really has not been reflecting in any way the heart of God, what unity is all about. Catholicism has released a lot of its hold. The Vatican II, you know, has allowed the whole Pentecostal, the whole charismatic movement to find its place within the Catholic Church, which in the days ahead may prove very, very exciting. You know, will the Catholic charismatics be able to stay? Or will we see another whole sort of split and reformation, you know, with them coming to join us and maybe the World Council of Churches joining sort of with the Church of Rome? And all these kind of things are possible. Things are on the move as far as the Church is concerned. Theology is in ferment. At the beginning of this century, you saw liberalism rife, deadness, death. A spark of light was with Karl Barth when he said, well, look, let's get back to experiencing God. Although many evangelicals had problems with what he had to say, he was pointing in the right direction. There was the new theology in the post-war era. People like Paul Tillich, John Robinson, with his Honest to God, saying the word God doesn't mean anything anymore. God is dead. The word God is dead. People have tried to get it, but in the end, they're using the word God because they can't find another word, because a word like ground of our being doesn't seem to mean anything to the man on the street. And people have wrestled with truth, how to express it. You know, theology really has gone in many directions. In South America, we have liberation theology, where the priests are taking out Sten guns and saying, we will get injustice, even if it means using bullets to do so. In the Far East, there's a man who wrote a book called Water Buffalo Theology. Going to church one day, he saw a little boy sitting on the back of a water buffalo, and he says, is the theology that I preach of any relevance to him? And so he went and wrote a book that put theology in terms that that boy could understand. So there have been experiments in theology, genuine good ones, as well as, you know, more liberal and perhaps negative ones. And of course, all through there's also been, you know, a very strong evangelical thrust behind everything. Also, there's been the suffering church in Russia and in China. Michael Bordeaux says that in the last 60 years, more than 2 million Christians have been put to death because of their faith, more than in the first three centuries of the early Christian church. And yet, although the church has suffered so terribly, as we heard again last night, you know, the church is vibrant. The churches are strong in communist countries, you know, as it has ever been. And perhaps with Russia may well collapse under need to give more freedom under economic pressure. And I remember hearing Natasha Vind saying, you people in the West, learn Russian, get ready to go in there, because the doors will open in the days ahead. So we could see amazing and exciting things taking place there. But of course, there's been the whole spirit and growth of the church. The whole Pentecostal movement is something quite unique in the history of the church that's taken place this century. Whatever you call it, revival, you know, Pentecostal, charismatic, God's spirit has moved in a unique way. In 1900, in Bethel Bible College in Topeka, in Kansas, the principal, Charles Parham, set his students to study what the biblical basis for the baptism of the Spirit really was. They came up with the fact that it was there, and it was evidenced by speaking in tongues. And at 7 p.m. on 31st of December 1900, Agnes Osman received the baptism of the Spirit under Parham's hands and spoke in tongues. And that was the beginning of the whole charismatic Pentecostal era that has been so dramatic in our age. By 1906, only about 1,000 people in America had actually come into that experience. 1904, the Welsh revival in Tonypandy under Evan Roberts raised worldwide excitement. There was crossflow between that and what was happening in America. In a little back street, what had been a livery stable and a timber yard and even a Methodist chapel at one time, a place called Azusa Street. Upstairs, you know, there was a meeting that lasted almost non-stop for 3 years. It's quite true. People from all over the world either came or wrote letters to find out what was happening. What was happening in Wales, what was happening in Azusa Street. Just thrilled people. People were just buzzing with what God was doing. There was no preaching. People went to the meetings and they just prayed. Anyone who tried to preach almost always dried up. It was led actually by a man called W.J. Seymour, who was a Negro, who was blind in one eye, very disheveled in his dress. Was uneducated virtually, and yet under that man's ministry, you know, the Pentecostal flames just began to sort of move across the world. Thomas Barrett, a Cornishman who'd actually gone to Scandinavia, went over to America to try and raise funds for a new chapel hall, got baptized in the Spirit, went back to Scandinavia, preached the baptism of the Spirit. Alexander Boddy from All Saints in Sunderland went over to hear his ministry, came back, started preaching the baptism of the Spirit in his church, began to hold annual conferences in Sunderland. And so the whole Pentecostal movement began to sort of take root in this country. Bodhi actually went over to India not long, I think it was 1906, and there found Indian girls the year before who under the anointing of the Spirit had spoken and prayed fluently in English, which they didn't know. You know, so everywhere, you know, God was sort of moving. Now, obviously, the Pentecostals found that the very nature of their experience and everything led to many people coming in on the fringes, perverting it, false doctrine coming in. And that is why the Pentecostal church, I think reluctantly, but established clear denominations. So they had the Assemblies of God, the Apostolic Movement, Elim, and these others. Now, from that sort of reservoir of experience and excitement, another whole swell of the movement of God was taking place in what we would call, you know, the charismatic movement. This has three sources. One was the Pentecostal church. 1939, David du Plessis in South Africa was prophesied over by Smith Wigglesworth, who told him that he would take the Pentecostal message to the historical denominations, and he began to do that. There were young men in the Brethren who desired to see God's Spirit moving as it had done in the New Testament church. There was this New Testament church influence. In the Isle of Lewis in 1951, and people got excited. So people from these three streams came together. They began to have conferences and talk about what God wanted to do with the church today. In 1960, which is probably the flashpoint of what we would call the charismatic movement, in California, publicly shared with his church his experience of the baptism of the Spirit, and was promptly dismissed from his position of pastor. But that caught the news headlines. And the news of that came over to Britain. And the whole outflowing of the charismatic movement began. And really, there's been no holding it sort of ever since. Amazing, in 1966, there were a group of lay teachers in a Catholic university in Pittsburgh in the United States of America. They were involved in social work. They were involved in the 60s sort of social thing. And they came across Dave Wilkerson's book, Crossing the Switchblade. And it's amazing how many times I found the people who've been... key things that happen in the charismatic movement have been sparked off by that book. And they read this book and they thought, you know, what is this? We want this. And they came together, they began to pray, and God met them in the experience of the Holy Spirit. And so the whole charismatic experience began to flow out into the Catholic Church, which I believe, you know, are amazing results. And I read in a newspaper just a short while ago, which said that 10% of all Catholics in this country are influenced directly by charismatic prayer meetings, which is something that is really quite fantastic. And of course, you know, God is leading us on into all sorts of things. We've moved on from the sort of the experience of the baptism of the Spirit into what God's purposes for the church are. And I don't need to go into all of that. We're all really sort of familiar with that. But the amazing thing is the way in which the world has been set on fire. The way in which Latin America, which in the 1950s had evangelism in depth, which said South America for Jesus in our generation. And this somehow caught the hearts of people. So today... you know, the church is doubling by sort of 10% annually, and it's estimated that in 1980 there were 30 million evangelicals in a population of 300 million. And it's estimated that by the year 2000, 20% of Latin America will be evangelical Christian, which is fantastic. And then in Africa, there's actually a race going on for where the church is growing fast. Is it Latin America, is it Africa, or is it the Far East? And really, there's often not much to choose between it. Africa has seen phenomenal growth in the church. And of course, Asia, we all know about Korea, but that's not the only place the church is growing. So the world literally is on fire with the Spirit of God. And, you know, we're really called to be part of that. And I believe from our historic background, we have so much to give. You know, we have, you know, we've been the people who've catalogued the history of the church, and we have a lot of experience to bring. But we, you know, God's moving, whether we want to share in that or not, you know. And I think, you know, that's the exciting thing. God is on the move. And although there may be nuclear shadows and things like that, God's going to do his thing through his church, and no one is going to stop him. There, I will stop. I've even got more, but I'll stop there. Thank you for bearing with me.